This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, News Director Dave Thompson visits with Interim President of Dickinson State University, Stephen Easton, about budget cuts. But first, an annual concert with veteran musicians and artists celebrating emerging musicians and artists. Celebration of Women and Their Music, now in its 23rd year, raises scholarship money for young women in the arts. The main event is this Saturday with a concert at the Spirit Room in Fargo at 6:30 p.m. Bismarck singer-songwriter Chris Kitko is one of this year's featured performers, and she spoke with our Eric Dethridge.
Hey, I'll tell you what, can we start out with a song?
Yes, I want to start out with a song that was inspired when I was kayaking down the Missouri River and just the beautiful land in North Dakota, and I thought we need some dance tunes for North Dakota, so it's a CD full of happy songs about North Dakota. I'm going to need your help with this one, though.
Okay, yeah. Audience participation?
That's right, you don't have to sing, you can dance
scared.
If you want to.
Okay, that's very scary.
So this will help you. This will help you learn how to spell North Dakota if you don't already know. And if you do know, it'll help you learn how to spell North Dakota really fast. And then you can kind of start thinking about what country and states are to the east and south and west and north of here, okay? So everyone can participate. N-O-R-T-H-D-A-K-O-T-A. 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 Here in North Dakota, what's west of the border? Let me hear it from ya.
Montana.
You betcha. N-O-R-T-H-D-A-K-O-T-A. N-O-R-T-H-D-A-K-O-T-A. Here in North Dakota, what's north of the border? Let me hear it from ya.
Manitoba.
Well, that works. Manitoba, Canada, anything up there. You betcha. N-O-R-T-H-D-A-K-O-T-A. N-O-R-T-H-D-A-K-O-T-A. Here in North Dakota, what's east of the border? Let me hear it from ya.
Minnesota.
You betcha. You're really good at this. N-O-R-T-H-D-A-K-O-T-A. N-O-R-T-H-D-A-K-O-T-A. One more. Here in North Dakota, what's south of the border? Let me hear it from ya.
South Dakota.
You betcha. N-O-R-T-H-D-A-K-O-T-A. N-O-R-T-H-D-A-K-O-T-A. Very good, Eric.
I was going to say Saskatchewan, but...
Now, I would have accepted that answer. What do you want to call our band?
Talent and not.
No. Oh, we're going to have our first band fight because I won't go with that one.
All right. We got to argue about the name.
That's
now.
Right.
That's always
we're
a fun
real
thing.
Band.
Hey, it's Chris Kitko on Prairie Public live in studio. You have sort of a philosophy of music. The music is really for everybody.
Right.
And it really is especially true with kids. Talk about a little bit more your work with children and music.
Well, my background is education. I have a teaching degree and a master's in education. And it would be hard for me to split up or to prioritize. I'm an educator, I'm a musician. They both go together. And I think we are music. I mean, our hearts beat. We have frequencies, literally. You know, if you go to the doctor and, you know, they can hook you up to electronic things that can measure this or that. So it's a part of us, literally. And it can belong to everyone. We have so many shows where people are voted off or judged or this or that. And when I was having a recital, when those things first started, those voting shows, the kids were scared to death to be in the recital, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And they finally said to me, I don't want to be voted off. So that's where I really began sort of a philosophy of inclusion, and everyone has a voice or an instrument that they can play.
And you teach, literally, you do teach them various instruments, right?
Right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's your favorite one to teach a kid?
Oh, boy. I don't know if I have a favorite, but I do a lot of guitar and a lot of piano and some percussion and then some other instruments like ukulele and things like that.
So you made a decision a long time ago that you weren't going to play the game as a touring musician, and that you wound up kind of rooting yourself in Bismarck. Tell us about that kind of journey and how being a working musician in Bismarck is not settling.
Wow, that's such a, thank you for that question. Really gets me thinking. Yes, I was playing a show in Chicago, and there were some bigger names there, and I don't want to name drop, because that's what was happening. Everyone was sort of competing for the attention of the famous ones. And there was this woman in the corner reading a book, and I knew who she was, but she wasn't talking to anybody. And then when the show started and people kind of went here and there to get ready, she just kept reading a book, and I went and asked her what's up. And she said she just doesn't want to have anything to do with that whole thing. You have to do that if you want to get somewhere. And I just didn't realize that that would be my life, living in a van for a while indefinitely, not really having a community and having to rub elbows and make sure people knew that I was rubbing elbows. So when I came back here, I didn't know how long I would be here. I thought it may be a short time. I didn't really know. I started doing lessons again, as I had done when I lived here before, and I realized I was part of a community. The kids would give me presents for my birthday that they had made, or they'd just give me a Just Because present. I still have a bracelet from Megan. Hey, Megan, that she put Kitty Co. on there, and now she's working somewhere in California or whatever. And I realized I've got a really special thing here. I'm part of a community. I can play for people's weddings or funerals or birthday parties, and I really like that. I have students now who are the children of former students, and there's just nothing like that.
You know, we talk about the Fargo music scene a lot and the music community. We haven't had a chance to talk much about the Bismarck music community. Can you describe how supportive that is, being a playing musician around town?
Yeah, I have heard that other places, and I don't know which other places, but when people have lived elsewhere, and I've found it too, there's a certain cutthroat competition sort of thing. And maybe I'm oblivious, but I haven't felt that here. It seems very supportive. There have been musicians who have said, hey, you want to do a gig with me or come play at this place? And I don't know. It just seems more like it's kind of cliche, but like a musical family around here. So, you know, it's not a huge city, so there aren't a million places to play, but they've been very open here.
Well, if you're just joining us, hello, hello. I'm Eric Etheridge, and we're joined by Chris Kitko, who's playing the 23rd Celebration of Women and Their Music at the Spirit Room in Fargo Saturday night. So, Chris, can we get another song, please?
Sure. As Deb Jenkins had said recently, the focus for the celebration is sort of turning back to its roots of local musicians, or more regional musicians, I guess. And here we go. This is another song off my North Dakota Songs album. And it's kind of a love song to the Badlands. And I want to keep it upbeat because I want these to be dance tunes for North Dakota. So you may learn a few things about this song. I researched for about a year before I recorded this album. I had a lot to learn. So it's packed with info. Feel free to join me in any way you want to. It's called Badlands. I'm Badlands, rough and rugged, big horn sheep and wild horses. I'm so scary, crops won't grow. Woo! There's a hairy buffalo. I'm sharp as cactus, smooth as stone, carved by years of erosion. My wood's so scared, it's petrified. My burrs on your shoes wanna hitch a ride. See, 60 million years ago, streams from the Rocky Mountains flowed, formed buttes and valleys and tablelands. But you can call me Badlands. I'm Badlands, rough and rugged, big horn sheep and wild horses. I'm so scary, crops won't grow. Woo! There's a hairy buffalo. As the years went by, I grew up. especially when the volcanoes blew up and sent dusty clouds of blue and gray that eventually settled as bentonite clay. Whoa, there's lightning. It's gonna ignite my underground layers of lignite. I'll burn the hematite. That's what scoria is. See my beautiful layers of reds and oranges. And now, flash forward a few million years. We got elk, we got bison and white-tailed deer. 180 species of birdies, wildflowers and the little Missouri snakes. Eagles, prairie dog towns. I'm the baddest western land around. I'm Badlands, rough and rugged. Big horn sheep and wild horses. I'm so scary, crops won't grow. Woo! There's a hairy buffalo.
Love it. It's Chris Kitko here on Prairie Public. Has the State Tourism Board contacted you yet? They got that actor guy doing things, but you got a song like this. I mean,
I would love that. Yeah, the song, the CD is a 16 song CD all about North Dakota. So yeah, give me a call.
And then how can people find your music and songs like that? Where can they go fetch them?
My website and Facebook. My website is Kittyko, KittyKo, not CO. .com, kittyko.com, and all that stuff is there. And on Facebook, it's under Kittyko Music.
Celebration of women and their music, it seems right up your alley, Chris. I mean, these are a lot of young musicians. Some of the award winners that they have are going to get a chance to perform, as well as some established artists like yourself, Jesse Veeder. So there's all kinds of networking that goes on there, some mentoring. So what's a celebration like this like for you?
Well, I think of the very first time I played, and I'd played around before, but I was really nervous, and I get to it was at the Fargo Theater back then, and I go downstairs to the dressing rooms, and all the dressing rooms are full, the hallway is full, there's nowhere to go, and I don't know anybody, so I'm sure I had the vibe of like the angel of death or someone, you know, because I'm not very friendly, I'm just kind of, So I go back way down the hallway to the corner, and there's this garbage can, you know, it's the only thing that's there. I don't know if you've ever bonded with an inanimate object, you know, like when you're desperate, there's this garbage can, it just kept me company, you know. So I'm listening, the show starts, and we have strict rules back then that we were to follow, that it's 7 minutes, you go on, you come off, you go downstairs, you don't hang around backstage because it gets too clogged, as much as you want to watch, just, you know. So we have to keep it professional, keep it flowing. So I go up there, I do my songs. I really don't know how it's going over yet because I'm dazed and the lights are in my eyes and all that. Seems to go okay. So I leave, and as I'm walking off the stage, I hear this commotion in the crowd. But I'm doing my part and going out down the stairs. And I don't know if you know Prairie Rose Seminole, but she was managing the theater at the time, or at least at that point, and she's a strong woman. You do what she says. She's a powerful, wonderful person. And I hear this, hey! And I don't turn around because it can't be for me. Hey! Happens again. So I turn around and Prairie Rose cracks a smile. She goes, get back out there. What? Get back out there. So, you know, I'm trying to find the curtain and the, you know, I stumble out on stage and thinking I don't want to go out there. They're cheering for somebody that's on there. But no, they're standing and they're clapping and they're looking at me. They were clapping for me.
Wow.
And that was the moment that I realized if, you know, I thought about that garbage, you know, I was just with a garbage can a couple of minutes ago. This is, we are here to share what we have, you know, and to be grateful for the opportunities that we have to share what we can. I was filled with such gratitude and humility at that point, and that is a lesson I turn to often when I think about that day.
Well, you'll be at the main show at the Spirit Room Saturday evening in downtown Fargo. Doors are at 6. The show kicks off at 6:30 p.m. Now, some of the other wonderful musicians set to take the stage include Jesse Veeder Schofield, Hot Lunch, Taylor Page, and Viotti String Quartet, just to name a few. Can you tell us what kind of set you're going to deliver? It's going to be kind of like we're having now, a lot of these very easy to sing along to songs.
Yeah, they are. I'm going to take a little bit different approach than the past, where I've done those more irreverent kind of humorous political type songs. These are more let's get up and move, let's sing along, let's sing about this beautiful state. We may have differences of opinion, but I think we can all agree it's a beautiful, beautiful place with beautiful people. So that's where I will be coming from.
Hear, hear. Now, Chris, we just started this Dakota Datebook series that marks the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment in North Dakota, which, of course, finally, belatedly gave women the right to vote. And you've done some special women's suffrage shows. So how do you feel about this moment in time?
This is it's surreal. I don't know how else to explain it. The women I've met and the men I've met, I did a performance that Susan Wiefald and others put together at the Heritage Center about a month and a half ago. And I don't know, I'm kind of speechless. I don't know if I can say much about it. It's I would like to share a song, though.
Yeah, could you take us out with one? That'd be great.
Yeah, that we did at the event. And this is another one that you're welcome to sing along in the chorus. If you're in your car, just go for it. Don't be shy. This is a state suffrage song that is sung to the tune of Marching Through Georgia, which is a Civil War tune, or was a Civil War tune. It appeared actually about 106 years ago, 1 week ago, January 8th, 1914, in the Hope Pioneer. So think about these lyrics and think about them appearing in a North Dakota newspaper over 100 years ago.
Votes for North Dakota women, sing it loud and clear. Sing it till the sleeping one shall waken up and cheer. Half a score of suffrage states and sending us a cheer. While we are marching to victory, hurrah, hurrah, we'll bring the jubilee. Hurrah, hurrah, we women shall be free. So we sing the chorus while with vision free. We see votes for ND women. Let's do the chorus again. Wherever you are, feel free to sing along. Here we go. Hurrah, hurrah, we'll bring the jubilee. Hurrah, hurrah, we women shall be free. So we sing the chorus while with vision free. We see votes for ND women. We see votes for ND women. See you Saturday.
Chris Kitko, thank you so much for hanging out with us on Prairie Public.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
And you can see Chris Kitko and several other performers this Saturday in Fargo at the Spirit Room at 6:30 p.m. for the 23rd Annual Celebration of Women and Their Music. Chris was speaking with our Eric Dethridge. Coming up next on Main Street, a Plains Folk essay.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, we speak with President Jefferson about the separation of powers.
Do they come from Montesquieu's The Spirit of the Laws, written in the mid-18th century, or all the way back to the ancient world and the Roman political theorist Polybius?
Mr. Jefferson has some particularly strong opinions about how this all fits together.
Jefferson was afraid of executive power, even though he used some of it when he was the third president of the United States, but he believed the more you diffuse power over a broad number of individuals and entities, the safer we are from tyranny.
And he wrote about it.
Yes, in his Kentucky Resolutions of 1798, in response to the Alien and Sedition Laws, he said, "In questions of power, then, let no more be heard of confidence in man, but bind him down from mischief by the chains of the Constitution."
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Sunday at 11 Central, 10 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Last week, historian Tom Ezern shared a Plains Folk essay that might have challenged your assumptions about hobos. Not necessarily someone causing trouble and then fleeing town before that trouble catches up, but rather as someone willing to go where the road takes them. He follows up that essay this week with Some Gang of Hobos.
One night in August 1897, a wooden railroad bridge over a dry coulee near St. Thomas, North Dakota, was consumed by fire. "There is no clue as to the origin of the fire," said press reports, which appeared in papers across the state, "but it is likely that some gang of hobos camping under the bridge fired it either intentionally or through error." Newspaper exchange items ignored the adverb likely in the news report and affixed headlines categorically stating that hobos had set fire to the bridge. Never mind, there was no observation of actual hobos being under the bridge, let alone any evidence they had set a fire. It was considered safe to assume hobos were the arsonists. Last week's Plains Folk outlined how, by close of the 19th century, hobos, or tramps, while still sometimes referred to as knights of the open road, came to be derided as vagrants who populated hobo jungles, generally under railroad bridges or in other sheltered spots along the railroad. Whence the tramps sallied forth to annoy, even terrorize, prairie folk on their farms or in their towns. Mainly in the towns, because farmers knew the value of transient labor and got to know the transients. Farmers particularly needed them for harvest and threshing in summer and fall, which was convenient since hobos tended to spend winters in more southerly climes, then come north for seasonal work. There were such things as hardcore hobos who would not work, but most would be better described as transients in search of work. Welcome when needed, despised when not. In 1923, the University of Chicago Press published a treatise, The Hobo, The Sociology of the Homeless Man, by Nels Anderson. The author ascribes the existence of the hobo class to a combination of economic conditions, the search for seasonal employment, and individual traits. The industrial attractions of seasonal work often make a powerful appeal to the footloose man and boy, writes Anderson. A new railroad that is building, a mining camp just opening up, an oil boom widely advertised, a bumper crop to be harvested in Kansas or the Dakotas fire the imagination and bring thousands of recruits each year into the army of seasonal and migratory workers. The swelling of the hobo tide was a problem that appeared locally, but could only be solved nationally. To deal with him, the hobo, even as an individual, society must deal also with the economic forces which have formed his behavior, with the seasonal and cyclical fluctuations in industry, says Anderson. This means that the problem of the homeless man is not local, but national. Still, Anderson recognizes a culture of the road extant among the hobos. He devotes an entire chapter to hobo songs and ballads. One hobo poem declares, "The bum on the rods is hunted down, an enemy of mankind." Because local people saw hobos not as a sociological phenomenon, but as a recurrent situation to be managed. There even was alarm that contact with hobos was a danger to children. The same sociologist, Anderson, published an article in the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology entitled "Juvenile and the Tramp." He warned, "There are intimate contacts between the tramp and the boy in town, but they are usually relationships that revolve around sex. Sex perversion is very prevalent among the tramp population." Thus, items such as this one, in August 1906, became common across the northern plains. A hobo camp with several gents of the road as inhabitants was broken up near Candu by the officers. Breaking up a hobo camp generally entailed violence. By the early 20th century, prairie folk and their officers of the law had defined hobos as a public danger.
Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, an appreciation of poetry. But now it's time for the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. The new State Ethics Commission has an executive director. David Thiele has accepted the job. Thiele is a former North Dakota National Guard member who headed the Guard's legal division. He retired from the Guard last year. Thiele says the Ethics Commission plans to meet next week to discuss the next steps.
Well, job one is to help the commission establish the parameters as far as what the complaint process is and what is a complaint. They've got to work through some inconsistencies between the Constitution and the legislature, and I think it's doable. I think they can get to a point where everybody's going to be comfortable that the process is fair, and we can improve ethics across the board for our government.
The Ethics Commission was created by public vote in 2018. A milestone in the cleanup of diesel fuel underground in downtown Mandan. The Mandan Remediation Trust will meet Wednesday to talk about closing the Mandan remediation site. Diesel fuel was first discovered in downtown Mandan in 1984. As the new law enforcement center was being built, State Department of Environmental Quality Director David Glott.
Right after that, we started doing some assessments, and it started to point towards the largest supplier of diesel fuel, which was Burlington Northern, and pointing in their direction as the cause of the problem.
Glott says it took some cajoling, but BN agreed to start recovery efforts using some wells, but he says that didn't do the job. Glott says when the state started negotiations with BN, he says there were court cases and arbitration. Glott says BN eventually paid $30 million, of which $24 million went toward the cleanup directly.
We were able to get a comprehensive cleanup system in place through a contractor that took several years to get to this point, but we were able to have success in cleaning up the diesel fuel, and to the point where we're at now where we're seeing very little, if no, diesel fuel on the water table, and we're able to close down the site and say for this point it is clean enough to meet the needs of downtown Mandan.
Glott says BN turned out to be a great partner in the cleanup effort.
These are the type of success stories that really have allowed downtown Mandan to begin to flourish again and bring in new businesses. One of the, what I see as a success is when you ask people in downtown area about the diesel spill remediation, I would say over half the time people respond like, what? Yeah, they don't know anything about it, which to me is a success.
State Department of Environmental Quality Director David Glott. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
Prairie Public's weekly web chat series is firing up for the new semester starting in January. This free professional development video series features area educators sharing resources, ideas, tips, and tricks to help teachers maximize their teaching power. No need to travel for inspiration. Get convenient, flexible PD from your home or classroom. Continuing education credit is available. Learn more at prairiepublic.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. For many a word lover, poetry holds a special place in their hearts. Patrick Hicks is an English professor and writer-in-residence at Augustana University in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He's also the curator of Poetry from Studio 47, where he discusses a regional poet. Today's poet is Brian Turner.
Turner was born on February 12, 1967, in Visalia, California. He grew up in Fresno. After receiving his BA and MA from Fresno State, he then earned a Master of Fine Arts from the University of Oregon. From there, he moved to Seoul, South Korea, where he taught English as a second language for a year. Following in family tradition, he decided to join the military, and between 1999 and 2000, he was deployed to Bosnia-Herzegovina. When the Iraq War began on March 20, 2003, Turner was deployed with the 3rd Stryker Brigade Combat Team, 2nd Infantry Division. While stationed in Baghdad, Mosul, and Balad, he began to write poetry in order to make sense of the war he was experiencing. These poems, written at night by the use of a red flashlight, resulted in his first collection of poetry, Hear Bullet. His viewpoint of the Iraq War in this collection is told with a generosity of spirit for his enemies, and he never loses sight of their humanity. Turner ended up winning the Beatrice Holly Award for Hear Bullet. and when he left the Army in 2005, he turned his attention to writing full-time. Turner has since written another collection of poetry, Phantom Noise, which was shortlisted for the prestigious T.S. Eliot Award in England, and he has won a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Poetry. Turner was also featured in the Academy Award-nominated documentary Operation Homecoming, Writing the Wartime Experience. His latest book is a memoir about his experiences in the Iraq War called My Life as a Foreign Country. He directs the MFA program at Sierra Nevada College, and he is married to the poet Elise Kuznets. Brian Turner's work is more than just about a soldier talking about his experiences. It involves questions about the wide sweep of history, why we are drawn to violence, and he clearly has a deep respect for Arabic culture. Today's poem is Jundi Amerikī. Here we have a poem in one long stanza. It takes place in a VA in Long Beach, California, and it involves a soldier who has bits of shrapnel and debris stuck in his body. A surgeon, Dr. Sosrata, is going about the business of removing this foreign material. It is weeping up through layers of the soldier's skin, much like how rocks work themselves up to the surface of a farmer's field. We come to find out that these bits of debris are in the soldier's body because of a suicide bomber, just as this American soldier, this Jundi Amerikī, as he would be known in Arabic, has literally absorbed parts of the war into his body. He must also learn how to absorb the emotional wounds that the war has given to him. And so, this is Jundi Amerikī by Brian Turner. At the VA hospital in Long Beach, California, Dr. Sosrata scores open a thin layer of skin to reveal an object traveling up through muscle. It is a kind of weeping the body does, expelling foreign material, sometimes years after injury. Dr. Sosrata lifts slivers of shrapnel, bits of coarse gravel, road debris, diamond points of glass, the minutiae of the story reconstructing a cold afternoon in Baghdad, November of 2005. The body offers aged cloth from an abaya dyed in blood, shards of bone, and if he were to listen intently, he might hear the roughened larynx of this woman calling up through the long corridors of flesh, saying Allah Akbar before releasing her body's weapon, her dark and lasting gift for this Jundi Amerikī, who carries fragments of the war inscribed in scar tissue, a deep, intractable pain, the dull grief of it the body must learn to absorb.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. All poems are used with permission. It's recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Up next, budget cuts come to Dickinson State University.
The exacting skills of Polynesian mariners.
They really were amazing navigators. They weren't sailing blind.
The legendary sites of the ancient Greeks.
It's a place where the world touches the underworld.
And the pleasures of traveling in Greece today.
Start with an ouzo, with a little ice and some water and a little feta cheese and some olives.
It's all on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tomorrow at 8 Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. There are tough times ahead for Dickinson State University, which is facing a multi-million dollar budget shortfall. News director Dave Thompson spoke with interim president of Dickinson State, Stephen Easton.
I understand that you've been holding some, you know, kind of open door sessions, some meetings around campus. What's your impression of how things are going at Dickinson State?
Well, overall, Dickinson State is and has been a very strong institution. We have a very significant budget issue to deal with, and there will be some. It'll be painful to deal with that process. I have announced to the campus that on Thursday, January 16th, at 2 o'clock, I will send an email outlining my proposed plan. We have to come up with essentially $2.35 million per year of expenditure reductions in order to reach a balanced budget. That's a significant amount. It already has involved some reduction of non-personnel expenditures. It already has involved some early retirements and voluntary departures under incentive terms, but that has not been sufficient, although those efforts have been very helpful, has not been sufficient. And so there will be some currently occupied positions that will be eliminated. And so that will be a painful process. But overall, you know, Dickens State's my alma mater, and overall, this, we are in good shape. But that's going to be a tough day.
And you have been you've made no secret about it that this is something that Dickens State is facing, and so everybody is aware of it. Then you'll have more details coming up.
Yes, I mean the reason I set a specific date and time is, I think that to the extent possible, everybody should hear, have the opportunity, all the Dickens Estate community should have the opportunity to learn about it at the same time. But yes, I think people are aware that this is happening. They were aware of it before I arrived back on campus. And I think people are ready for us to get past, to make the tough, very tough decisions involved and then get past it. Nonetheless, it's going to be hard when it actually happens and there are actually identified positions that are going to be eliminated. That's going to be hard. Good people who work for Dickens Estate will lose their jobs in the process, and that's a very painful thing.
It sounds like that if you can get past this bump in the road, maybe there's a sunshine after that.
I do believe that the thing with these with circumstances like a budget problem to deal with is they sort of hang in the air, and I think it's helpful to resolve them, even though it's painful to resolve them, and then move on, because I do believe there are some very bright days ahead for Dickens and State. There are some things on the short-term horizon. We just last year became a dual-mission university, which is going to provide us opportunities to do things like workforce training and other things that we have in some master's degree programs and other things that we haven't traditionally done. So those are exciting opportunities. Pulver Hall, which was originally built as a dorm residence for Dickens Estate, but over the last several decades has been rented out to various agencies, is going to become again a full part of our campus with a, and that's where the Dickens Estate Theodore Roosevelt program will be housed. We have for a small school of somewhat unusual but very beneficial honors program, the Theodore Roosevelt Honors Leadership Program, for a portion of our students, and they will now have a residential home in Pulver Hall. So there's lots of good things on the horizon, and I do believe that we can pivot out of these budget issues into some very good times. The dual mission means providing post-high school education beyond the what one might think of as the traditional liberal arts education. So for us, the dual mission programs that we already have up and operating are a CNA, and a certified nursing assistance program, a specialized short-term program in writing and / communication. We are in the process of trying to get a welding program up and operational. And so things like, for example, a welding program are not the kind of programs that have traditionally been part of the liberal arts campuses in what are sometimes referred to in North Dakota as the regional campuses, Dickinson State, Minot State, Valley City, and Mayville. And so it's particularly because of the portion of the state that we are in, there's a lot of demand for workforce training. And it's a way, in a sense, for us at Dickinson State to diversify our portfolio. And I think it's a really exciting opportunity to broaden our reach within southwestern North Dakota. And we are not by any means leaving our traditional liberal arts programs and degrees behind. This is an addition to those programs, not any sort of a substitution for those programs.
But aren't you getting some pushback from anybody? I know there was a little bit of rumbling when it was talked about at first, but that seemed to have died down. Are you hearing any negativity toward that?
Well, there is an issue that we have to work out because of the Train ND program that is centered in the four state colleges. I'm confident we'll be able to work it out. An issue that sort of has existed in North Dakota higher education as long as I have been aware of North Dakota higher education, which is, I'm not sure I should admit this, but that's quite a few decades now, is to what extent should the state North Dakota institutions compete with each other, or to what extent do we sort of carve out separate territories and not have repetition of programs? And there are some issues related to that with our dual mission, but I feel optimistic that we'll be able to resolve those issues and provide some really good programming here.
Bismarck is kind of doing a dual mission, Bismarck State, with the Polytechnic Institute, where they're going
right.
to start offering the four-year degrees in applied science. So there's
right.
some things that we think of two-year schools and four-year schools and trade schools, and the lines are kind of blurring, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing.
Dave, I think that's an astute observation. I do think that is happening to some extent. And I think I'm part of our dual mission, so I think it is a good thing. One of the things about Dickinson State is that we are, the institution for a fairly significant chunk of the state, not the only institution, obviously, and it's not the only option for higher education for students. But I do think it makes sense for us to provide some things like workforce training in addition to traditional liberal arts education, which will remain a big part of our program.
Well, in other words, you're meeting what your constituents want.
I would agree. And Dickinson is a very interesting city within the state of North Dakota, because with the possible exception and probable exception of Fargo, a lot of people that haven't spent much time in Dickinson do not necessarily realize that Dickinson has a very diverse economy. In addition to the things that are obvious, which are agriculture, of course, which is important across North Dakota, the oil and gas industry, which is very significant in this part of the state. What people don't necessarily realize if they haven't spent a lot of time in Dickinson is there's a significant manufacturing industry in Dickinson. And that gives us an asset, that sort of diversification of the economy. That's a really good thing for Dickinson and for Stark County. And we want at Dickinson State to be involved in that and providing education for all of those constituencies in our part of the state. We have a very strong agricultural program that has been very strong for approximately a couple of decades. We'd like to get into some training that will assist those who are seeking employment in the oil and gas industry.
So now I have a question about your tenure. How long did you sign a contract for in terms of being the interim president?
Well, the contract actually doesn't have a specified ending date, but the understanding I have with the North Dakota University system is that I have a leave of absence from my position as professor of law at the University of Wyoming that will last through June 30th. So that's effectively my commitment at this point to Dickinson State.
I think by you saying that at this point, that leads me to my other question. Are you interested perhaps in the job on a permanent basis?
I think that's a good way to put it, Dave. I am perhaps interested. And of course, there's all kinds of contingencies there. The chancellor and the North Dakota University system and the State Board of Higher Education will have to make a decision at one point about whether they would be interested in me beyond this interim period. I'll have to make a decision also. I mean, this Dickens Estate is very much a passion for me and for my family. I'm one of four generations of my family that has had the wonderful benefit of a Dickens Estate education and degree. And so I am here because I think it's a critical time in our university's existence, and I'm hoping that I can contribute. I have a job at the University of Wyoming that I also very much enjoy. And so there isn't any commitment at this point beyond June 30th. We'll have to see also if indeed folks will want me around after the budget cut process. As we said earlier, that's going to be a very painful process, and there will be some criticism, which is fine at a public, especially a public institution. Criticism is fine of the decisions that I make, but have to make a judgment about whether there would be any appetite for having me serve beyond this 6-month period. So that's all up in the air. But it is. But to go to your question, am I perhaps interested? That's a good way to put it.
Okay.
I am holding open the possibility of an interest in continuing after June 30th.
Well, in terms of the budget cuts, you were dealt a hand, and you have to play the cards you were dealt, basically.
Yes, and I think most people understand that, but it's still a mighty difficult proposition to lose your job if you're a person that's in a job. That happened to me once in my career, and it was under circumstances where I knew it was coming, but it's a tough thing. And I'm going to encourage people to understand that while they certainly have a right to be disappointed in that decision, I hope that they will continue to have, after initial and very understandable disappointment, I hope they'll continue to have a very strong relationship with Dickens Estate, and to the extent that they will remain employed, as many of them will, after that decision is made for a period of time. I am hopeful that they will continue to perform in a great way for Dickens Estate, so we'll be able to tell people, even after that position was eliminated, blank was an amazing employee.
Well, those are the questions I had. Is there anything that you'd like to add?
The main point, I think, and I think we should cover this right at the beginning, Dave, but the main point is that, yes, this is a difficult process with our current budget situation, but there's a lot of hope for a bright future here. As proud as I am of the past of Dickens Estate, and I'm a part of that past as a former student, I really believe that as strong as our past is, that the best days of Dickens Estate are in the future.
That was our news director, Dave Thompson, visiting with interim president of Dickens Estate University, Stephen Easton. Dakota Daybook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 14th. Before there was a weather channel or a weather app for your smartphone, people looked to nature to predict the weather. Animals were considered reliable forecasters. If there was more orange than black on a woolly bear caterpillar,
well, the winter would be mild. More black than orange meant a hard winter. If horses grew a thick coat early in the fall, winter would come early with cold temperatures and lots of snow. The same for early migrations of geese, ducks, and monarch butterflies. And if the snowy owl arrived early, that was also a warning of a cold, hard winter. On this date, in 1909, an article in the Hope Pioneer alerted readers to signs for the weeks ahead, some of which farmers supposedly knew and heeded. They all pointed to cold and snow as winter continued into the new year. The first predictor mentioned was the pig. Since early October, the tails of pigs were curled up very tightly. Presumably, this was to prevent the tails from freezing and was acknowledged as a reliable prediction. Woodchucks agreed with the pig's forecast. Ordinarily, woodchucks dig burrows no deeper than 4 feet, but in 1909, according to the Hope Pioneer, quote, this fall they hired steam shovels and went down 20 feet or more and then insisted on feather beds at the bottom, unquote. The frogs had a similar plan. Instead of burrowing just a foot deep, again quoting from the Pioneer, this winter they have gone down 5 or 6 feet and have taken a supply of coal with them, unquote. Okay, so there may have been a slight exaggeration regarding the woodchucks and frogs. However, other signs also pointed to a rough winter. Migrating birds left North Dakota a full 2 weeks early. Potato vines and turnip tops wilted 10 days earlier than was normal before a mild winter. Hens stopped laying eggs in November and had grown plumage thicker than usual. Farmers started observing the signs in August to predict the coming winter. More fog than usual or a hot first week in August warned of cold weather to come. In 1909, they couldn't turn on the weather channel, so all they could do was go outside to see what Mother Nature was up to. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
On the next morning edition, the impeachment trial is happening. Will the lawmakers deciding the president's fate stick to their party lines?
Every U.S. senator ought to be looking at this in a nonpartisan term.
Also, scientists launch an experiment with help from some unusual rodents.
We're going to call this project Sending Mighty Mice to Space.
Listen for all kinds of stories on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, sabbaticals are fairly common in a college or university setting, and they allow a professor to dive deeply and reconnect with their work. Well, two artists are hoping to get that concept and bring it to artists. We hear from Brandon LaPlante and Britta Anderson. They are co-founders of The Tired Artists. This is a fellowship set up to raise money for sabbaticals for established artists. Also joining the conversation is David Borlaug of the Capitol Gallery, which is serving as the fellowship's fiscal host. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.